Hey, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is October 30th. It is October 30th. We're in endocrinology chapter, and we'll probably finish that up today, and then maybe move into muscle. So let's see, when is your next test? November 13th. So we're not quite in November yet, but if today's the 30th, and it's one and a half weeks away, is that right? Yeah, just 1.5 weeks away. So the 13th is a Thursday. Okay, so those of you that have Thursday lab, you'll have a quiz, lab quiz, and a test on the same day. That's the way it goes. At least you don't have a practicum, right, which is okay. So we did start endocrinology chapter last time. And just refresh, let's see, what the heck is a hormone? We should know what a hormone is. What's a good definition of a hormone? What secretes a hormone? Something secretes a hormone. Endocrine gland. Of course, that's kind of a loaded term because you have other kinds of glands besides endocrine. What's another kind besides endocrine? Exocrine, yeah. And what makes those two different? What about exocrine has ducts and an endocrine has no ducts, right? Glands always produce a product and secrete that product outside the cell. Right, and so I can understand how an exocrine gland works because it secretes its product into a duct. The duct carries it to where it belongs, and that it does its job there. But how does an endocrine gland, if it doesn't have a duct, how does its product of secretion get to a place where it does its job? That's right. A hormone is secreted by an endocrine gland, gets picked up by the circulatory system, delivered everywhere in the body. Right, and then how can it have an effect on a distant location? We call it a target tissue. How can it have an effect on a target tissue? That target tissue is only a target tissue if it has a receptor, right? So target tissue has to have a receptor. And then when a hormone binds to that receptor, it causes a change in the physiology of that cell. So that's what a hormone is, right? Secreted by an endocrine gland, it's transported by the blood, travels to a distant location where it binds to a receptor, and it changes the physiology of that target cell when it binds to a receptor. All right, so you should have all that. All right, so we were talking about receptors last time, and we noticed that some hormones can enter the cell. Why is it that some hormones can enter a cell? What's something special? What's something about the physical chemistry of a hormone that can enter the cell? It is hydrophobic or lipophilic, means it can move right across the cell membrane and it can enter the cytoplasm, and then there are receptors in the cytoplasm, cytoplasmic receptors for lipid hormones. Could you give me an example of a lipid hormone? Steroid, any number of steroids, right, like estrogen, testosterone, right, cortisone, aldosterone, all of those are steroids. We'll probably mention some more a little bit later. They have cytoplasmic receptors, and remember, when they bind to a receptor, a cytoplasmic receptor, then they usually act as a transcription factor, which means then that the first step in protein synthesis can start when that receptor is bound to a particular hormone. So those hormones work by controlling protein synthesis inside of a cell. And of course, that changes the structure of the cell, that changes the function of a cell, and that's how physiology happens, okay? What about hydrophilic hormones? Are there cytoplasmic receptors for hydrophilic hormones? I heard no. I like that. Why is that possible? Well, how come that happens? How come there's no cytoplasmic receptors for hydrophilic hormones or polar? Because they cannot cross the cell membrane. Right, so they can't get into where the receptor would be if it's cytoplasmic, so they have to have receptors that are outside the cell, on the cell membrane, for instance. Right, and so how is it that that signal that's outside, trapped outside the cell can actually make a difference of what's happening inside the cell? We've looked at some schemes already, and probably one of the easiest ones that we look at is when a ligand binds to an extracellular receptor, it can open or close an ion channel. And that can either what? Excite or inhibit a cell, depending on what ions are moving in which direction. Right, so that's a simple ion channel. But there are other kinds of external receptors that don't work through ion channels, and probably the most common one that you're familiar with is on this slide right here. And I think even for the first test, you had to memorize something about this scheme. No, you're not on. Oh, I was having a good time. Why is it not on? Because that button and that button isn't pushed. Should I go back over the schedule with you? I was pointing out stuff on the schedule. You didn't see it, but you were able to follow that? Good. Okay. All right, well, without the slide, maybe tell me, how is it that a signal that's outside the cell changes the physiology inside the cell, even if it can't get in? A really good example is a second messenger system, right? And a lot of second messenger systems work through what kind of receptor complex that you're aware of? Can you see it yet? It's coming. It's almost available. Is it too bright in here? Not for me. Okay, G-protein coupled receptor, right? So here's a scheme for a G-protein coupled receptor. Here is the extracellular receptor, right? So here's this blue represents the extracellular material. This beige is the intracellular material. The receptor is on the outside, and that's a nice phospholipid bilayer. What makes up the phospholipid bilayer? That's sort of a silly question because the answer was part of the question, but there might be a reason why I'm asking that. All right, so you should probably just tell me what makes up the phospholipid bilayer? Yeah, phospholipids, right? And this phospholipid is just a modified triglyceride, right? What are the components of a typical old regular triglyceride? There's glycerol and triglyceride. Three fatty acids, right? In one location, it's been replaced with a phosphate group right here to make it a phospholipid. But don't forget, this is just basically a triglyceride with one of the fatty acids converted into that. It has that amino and phosphate group. It's called a phosphatidyl group on it. All right, so phospholipid bilayer, a lot of lipid in this membrane. We're going to get to that on the very next slide. So when the hormone binds to the receptor, so here's the receptor. Receptor is coupled to a G protein. And you see the three subunits on this G protein. All right, it can dissociate, and the alpha subunit will diffuse around through that lipid layer in the cell membrane, or maybe right on the surface of the cell membrane, but it doesn't ever let go of the cell membrane. It moves around, and it can bump into other proteins that are embedded in the membrane or somehow associated with the membrane. And here's one of those proteins, and I see that it is taking ATP and making it cyclic AMP out of it, and this two phosphate group called a pyrophosphate, inorganic pyrophosphate. All right. And so cyclic AMP, it just means what? One phosphate on there, but it's a special form. What's a special form of AMP? It is cyclic. Yeah, it's a ring structure. So a ring structure has a different shape than regular old linear AMP. And so if you change the structure of something, you change the function, and cyclic AMP is what we have recognized for a long time in this class already as what? A second messenger. It builds up in the cytoplasm. Do you ever see cyclic AMP in the extracellular compartment outside the cell? Just look at this illustration right here. Do you ever see cyclic AMP outside the cell? No. Do you ever see hormone inside the cell? No. So where do you always find, what do we call the hormone in this particular scheme? First messenger. Where do you always find the first messenger? Outside. Where do you find the second messenger, which is cyclic AMP? It's inside the cell. Okay. And of course, you got to be really familiar with the enzyme that converts ATP into cyclic AMP. That should be on the tip of your tongue. That is adenylate cyclase, right? Adenylate cyclase. All right, and when adenylate cyclase catalyzes the first reaction of one ATP to a cyclic AMP, does it get used up? Does adenylate cyclase get used up when it catalyzes the reaction? No, because it's an enzyme. It can catalyze that reaction over and over and over and over again. Right, so for one hormone bound to one receptor, you can get many, many cyclic AMPs or second messengers inside the cell. I don't even want to say how many. I don't know. I don't know if it's 1,000 or 10,000 or whatever. But nonetheless, it's one first messenger to many, many, many second messengers. And what is that step? It's a transduction step, of course. It transduces that signal, the hormone signal, to this second messenger signal, right, across the membrane. But if it's a small signal on the outside and a huge signal on the inside, how else should you consider that step? It can be characterized as a if it's just one step right here, taking something small, making it bigger, that is amplification, right? So it's amplifying that signal from one hormone into many second messengers, right? So that is one step of amplification. Well, what does the cyclic AMP do? It will diffuse around inside the cell, can bump into a protein kinase, right? And a protein kinase, what does a protein kinase do? Yeah, it adds a phosphate to some protein someplace around inside the cell. But normally, there's an inhibitory subunit attached to this kinase, so it is inactive under most circumstances until this hormone binds to the receptor, because then that produces a second messenger. The second messenger will take that inhibitory subunit off the protein kinase, so now you have an active protein kinase. You have the inhibitory subunit all bound up to cyclic AMP, so that no longer is having an effect inside the cell, but this protein kinase is. And you see it's a, I see an ASE right here. What does that mean? It's an enzyme, right? So it will catalyze a reaction, and when it catalyzes a reaction, does it go away? Does it get used up? No, because it's an enzyme. So it can catalyze that reaction, what, over and over and over and over again, right? Not just one enzyme, but many, because we had many cyclic AMPs made, right? And so here we have a number of other proteins that can be activated or inactivated. So there's another level of amplification here, because this protein kinase doesn't get used up. It catalyzes that reaction over and over and over again. So what do we call a mechanism with at least two levels of amplification? That is what we call a cascade mechanism. Cascade mechanism just means that it allows for things to happen very rapidly inside the cell, even with a very small amount of first messenger outside the cell. So this is a particularly potent way of controlling the physiology inside the cell. All right, so cyclic AMP, one example of a second messenger. I gave you a list of second messengers for the previous test. Cyclic AMP was one of them. All right, and that was produced by what? Adenylate cyclase. This effect does not last forever, because cyclic AMP will be destroyed with some efficiency inside the cell. Eventually, it will be broken down. And you should tell me, well, first, remind me, what is the name of the enzyme that makes cyclic AMP? Adenylate cyclase. And then, because of antagonism, we would like to know the name of the enzyme that breaks cyclic AMP down. And that is we saw that with the vision system, that's a phosphodiesterase, right? Phosphodiesterase will break cyclic AMP down, terminating the effect of this hormone inside the cell. But remember, phosphodiesterase was something also used by rod cells to break down cyclic GMP, right? To stop the, we've covered the sensory chapter already, haven't we, in here? Yes, we have. Coming back to me, right? And when cyclic GMP is broken down, then the dark current is stopped. That's sodium influx into the rod cell. All right, so phosphodiesterase is an enzyme that will break a cyclic nucleotide down into a linear form of that nucleotide, thereby terminating the action of that second messenger. All right, here's another system. So here we have, well, what does it always start with? First messenger binding to a G protein coupled receptor. I don't see the alpha, beta, gamma units right here, but that's okay, right? That's a G protein. Here's the receptor. One hormone binds to this receptor. G protein dissociates. It will wander around inside the membrane. And if a subunit bumps into this hormone, I'm not hormone, this enzyme, and you can see that it is inside the membrane. I see maybe a little piece sticking into the cytoplasm, but not very much. This is phospholipase C. Probably somebody discovered a bunch of lipases. This is probably the third one somebody found and described, right? So they could have said phospholipase number 3, but it's C instead. And what is the substrate for a phospholipase? It says the substrate is part of the name. What's the substrate for a phospholipase? It is a phospholipid. Well, that's kind of unfortunate, because I don't see any phospholipids around phospholipase. Do you? Do you see any phospholipids?
Yeah.
The substrate for phospholipase C? It's surrounded by substrate, right? So maybe you were thinking that the membrane was just a structure, but in this particular case, it's a substrate for a very important chemical reaction, right? And the reaction is these phospholipid, or a phospholipid, will be broken down into inositol 3-phosphate. We're just going to call that IPI-3, right? IPI-3 then will move away from the membrane down a concentration gradient to endoplasmic reticulum. And what's one of the functions of endoplasmic reticulum? But before we get there, what kind of endoplasmic reticulum is this? Rough or smooth? It's smooth. What's one of the functions of smooth ER? Stores calcium. All right, so when IPI-3 bumps into the smooth endoplasmic reticulum that's storing calcium, it's going to open calcium channels. And remember, what's the concentration of calcium inside the cell? Pretty close to zero. Extremely high in this endoplasmic reticulum, so calcium is going to rush out by diffusion. And so now the second messenger in this case is going to be calcium from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And calcium then can bind to other kinds of regulatory proteins. Maybe you've heard of calmodulin before, and that can activate other kinds of enzymes inside the cell. So this is another second messenger system where the first messenger is a hydrophilic hormone binding to a G-protein coupled receptor, which then produces a second messenger inside the cell, which is calcium when it's released from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. And in this particular case, you could probably think of IPI-3 as being a second messenger as well. Okay? So both calcium and IPI-3 could be considered second messengers. And what could you invoke to help convince me that both calcium and IPI-3 are second messengers? Where they're found. Yeah. Where do you find calcium? Only inside the cell, right? And what about IPI-3? Never in the extracellular space, right, but inside the cell. So those are the second messengers. Okay. So phospholipase C, right, calcium diffuses into the cytoplasm, binds and activates calmodulin. Then calmodulin can activate various kinds of protein kinases, which phosphorylate enzymes, and that's kind of a major change in conformation. These enzymes are going to change shape, or maybe the active site is going to change somehow, and that can either inactivate or activate an enzyme, and then that will, what, that will promote or terminate various kinds of metabolic pathways inside the cell. Let's look at a really important example. What about glucose? What about glucose? What about blood glucose concentration? Should it be controlled in a homeostatic way? Yeah, shouldn't go too high, shouldn't go too low. It can vary a little bit, right? But when, and remember, your body can be in one of two states. You can be in a fed state, or you can be in a fasted state. Yeah, when you're in a fed state, glucose is being absorbed from your digestive tract. When you're in a fasted state, how is blood glucose maintained? Because there's no glucose in your digestive tract to maintain blood glucose. Yeah, from your liver, because your liver stores glucose in the form of glycogen, and that brings us to, I think, this slide right here. Indeed it does. Okay, I got to move my sunglasses a little bit out of the way. Okay, so here is a hormone, epinephrine. You can maybe consider it a neurotransmitter. There aren't many neurons that secrete epinephrine. Most neurons secrete what form of this compound? Mostly norepinephrine, but they're related, right? They're both involved with the sympathetic nervous system. And if you're going to think of sympathetic nervous system, what would be one way to characterize sympathetic nervous system generally through everything that it does? Yeah, fight or flight, right? So when you're going to be confronted with a very strenuous, maybe life-threatening situation, right, it's probably a really good idea to maintain blood glucose, because that's a nutrient that can produce ATP, right, through oxidative phosphorylation. So blood glucose should be maintained. So here we have, I'm sure this is a picture of a liver cell, says right here. We have glycogen in this liver cell. And under times of stress, there's going to be release of epinephrine. And you should know where this comes from. Where does this epinephrine come from? The adrenal medulla, right? The cells of the adrenal medulla are like the postganglionic fibers in a sympathetic outflow pathway. They don't send electrical impulses anywhere. They just directly release epinephrine primarily and a little bit of norepinephrine into the blood. And so you could consider then those things a hormone or a neurohormone. They get into the blood. They travel to the liver, right? And in order for them to have an effect on the liver, what does the liver have to have? They have to have a receptor, right? And epinephrine and norepinephrine are hydrophilic. That means they can't get into the cell. So what kind of receptors are going to be there? They're not going to be intracellular. They're extracellular on the cell membrane, right? And since they respond to epinephrine and norepinephrine, they're adrenergic receptors. And as a matter of fact, you probably could tell me a number of things about adrenergic receptors. There are two major classes of adrenergic receptors. What are those? Alphas and betas, and you learned some target tissues of those for the last test. Here is the liver. What's interesting, it has beta receptors and alpha receptors, right? So there is one system and there's a backup system, and we're going to see what they do. All right, let's talk about the beta adrenergic receptors first. Binds to the G protein, not shown on this diagram, but you can go back a couple slides and see what that looks like. And the activated and dissociated G protein is going to bump into adenylate cyclase. What's that going to do in the membrane? If adenylate cyclase is activated inside the membrane, what's going to happen? Is that going to allow epinephrine to enter this liver cell? No. What is it going to do? It's going to take ATP and make cyclic AMP. Adenylate cyclase is the enzyme that makes that happen. Right? So in this case, cyclic AMP is a second messenger. The first one is epinephrine. The cyclic AMP can activate a protein kinase, right? That was on the previous slide, activates a protein kinase, and that protein activates a protein kinase, and what does a protein kinase do? Phosphorylate something, and in this particular case, it's going to phosphorylate, it's a little bit complicated, but I'm going to simplify it a little bit. It's going to phosphorylate a glucose molecule and cleave it from the glycogen molecule. All right, so what's the building block of glycogen once again? Glucose, so it cleaves off a glucose, jams a phosphate on there, and that gives you what? Glucose-1-phosphate, right? Because what takes glucose and makes glucose phosphate out of it? It is a protein kinase, right? So we have glucose-1-phosphate free inside the cell, and a liver cell is pretty interesting because it's the only type of tissue in your body that can remove this phosphate from a glucose, right, and make it a free glucose. And if it's a free glucose inside of a liver cell, it can diffuse out and go into the blood. All right, so if your blood glucose concentration is decreasing, this beta adrenergic receptor is one way working with the liver to bring blood glucose concentration back up to where it should be, right? And when blood glucose concentration increases, then this epinephrine signal will go away, right? So this is a nice negative feedback mechanism maintaining homeostasis for blood glucose. All right, so that's one side of this diagram. What else do you see besides a beta adrenergic receptor on this liver cell? I see an alpha adrenergic receptor. Okay, and this alpha adrenergic receptor, when it binds norepinephrine, and again, it works through a G protein coupled receptor. It opens up a calcium channel. Calcium enters the liver cell, and you know that calcium, right, will activate calmodulin. Calmodulin can activate protein kinases. And again, this protein kinase is able to cleave a glucose molecule from glycogen, jam a phosphate group on there, right, to give you glucose-1-phosphate. So now you have glycogen with one less glucose there. And because liver cells have what kind of enzyme do they have that can convert glucose-6-phosphate into just plain old glucose with no phosphate? Probably you've heard it. I know you all know what it is. That is a phosphatase, right? Phosphatase, glucose-6-phosphatase. Now you have free glucose inside the cell. It can leave the liver, go into the blood, and then be delivered to any number of places inside the body that can use glucose, right? So here are some examples of G protein coupled receptors in the maintenance of blood glucose or glucose homeostasis. So here's a really nice concrete example. So the title of this slide says 2 second messengers, even with only 1 second messenger.
1 second messenger, namely epinephrine, can produce two different kinds of second messengers, cyclic AMP and calcium inside the cell. Both will stimulate, right, the secretion of glucose from a liver cell. And that glucose then could go to other tissues that need that glucose. Like, what would need glucose? What kind of cells would need glucose under times of stress? Muscle, right? For you to fly away or run away. Brain, heart, all of those tissues. So when you're dealing with that stressful circumstance, right, your body has plenty of glucose available in the blood. Even though it's being used very fast, it can be replenished by this glycogen that is in the liver. Now, who's got a question about that? Anybody have a question about this particular scheme? My guess, this is an exam figure. Does anybody know if this is an exam figure? I hope so. I hope to have at least a couple people here that know. Because you should have those printed out already and looking at them, right, and working with them, please. Okay. All right, another kind of receptor besides the G-protein-coupled receptor, and I'm sure a lot of you are going to be really interested in this one because I see the hormone. And this hormone is, what is this hormone that we're talking about? It is insulin, and you all are aware of insulin before you took this class. And if there is some abnormality in insulin levels in somebody or receptors for insulin in somebody, what kind of disease process do they have? What's the name of it? Yeah, diabetes mellitus, right? And diabetes mellitus, one way to think of it is that blood glucose stays high almost all the time. But here is the real important way to think about that. If blood glucose stays high all the time, it means it's not going someplace. It's stuck in the blood. Where is it not going? It's not going inside cells. So cells are starving to death because they don't have glucose. That's really the terrible thing. It's terrible to have a lot of glucose in the blood for osmotic reasons and other kinds of things. But think of these poor cells over here that don't have a substrate for glycolysis or other kinds of processes that can produce ATP for them. Right? And so under most circumstances, in order for glucose to enter a cell, it needs a signal. It needs a passport. Insulin is that passport. And this is how the insulin receptor works. It's called a tyrosine kinase receptor second messenger system. So we see that the insulin receptor, right, insulin is a polypeptide. It's hydrophilic. It has to have an extracellular receptor, not a cytoplasmic receptor. Nice phospholipid bilayer. And is this receptor a monomer or a dimer? I see two parts. That's a dimer. And they dimerize when insulin is present, right? So they form this complex right here. And so there's the extracellular side of the receptor, but it goes all the way across, right? The binding site for insulin is extracellular, but this protein goes all the way across the cell membrane, and it even pokes into the cytoplasm. And since it's bound in insulin, we call it now, it has been dimerized, right? And when that happens, there is an enzyme on the tip of this receptor that can take an ATP, convert it into ADP, and phosphorylate the end of this receptor. Right? And when it's phosphorylated, then there is another enzyme included in the receptor that can take an ATP, and it can phosphorylate other kinds of compounds that are inside the cell, maybe some other proteins. And what's being phosphorylated is an amino acid in these proteins that is called tyrosine. Tyrosine is just an amino acid, right? So now this thing right here is what we call a tyrosine kinase because it's going to phosphorylate a kinase. Kinase is just a building block of various kinds of proteins. And again, that changes the structure of those proteins, changes the physiology of what these proteins are doing inside the cell. So this receptor for insulin is what we call a tyrosine kinase receptor, because what is it doing? When the first messenger binds to the receptor on the outside, it starts to phosphorylate tyrosine, which is a building block of proteins inside the cell. And then that's going to change the physiology inside the cell, right? Because you're changing the structure of those kinds of proteins. And this is kind of a complex cascade of effects, maybe a number of levels of amplification. We're not going to go into too much detail. As a matter of fact, We're probably learning things about this cascade mechanism every single day, coming up with new kinds of pharmacological treatments for diabetes mellitus, right? But nonetheless, what you have to know is that insulin works through a tyrosine kinase receptor. And you can see that it's kind of complicated, right? So is it possible for somebody with diabetes mellitus to have normal levels of insulin, right, but not be able to transport insulin from the blood into cells? Let's just say insulin is normal. But in order for cells to take up glucose, not only do they need this insulin signal, they need what? A perfectly functioning tyrosine kinase receptor and a bunch of other regulatory proteins inside the cell in order to make that happen. So probably you're aware that there are two different kinds of diabetes, right? One is what's responsible, type 1, is when insulin is not present due to some kind of disease to the pancreas perhaps. And then type 2, normal insulin levels, but insulin is no longer having an effect on the cell because something has happened to this tyrosine kinase receptor or some kind of cascade mechanism that happens after that. So there are two major kinds of diabetes. All right, so what happens after this? All right, so here, what do we got right here? Got a nice cell. Here's the cell membrane. Glucose cannot enter the cell because glucose is hydrophilic, right? And what kind of compounds can move through the cell membrane once again? Can hydrophilic compounds move through the cell membrane? No, only hydrophobic. So glucose can't move through the cell membrane. That's why if insulin is not working properly or that whole mechanism isn't working properly, glucose is trapped outside the cell. The cell is starving to death. So in order for glucose to enter, even though it's high outside and low inside, it still needs some help getting across the membrane. And when it goes from high to low concentration, what do we call that? Is that active transport or passive transport? Here we have high glucose outside, low inside the cell. That's passive, right? And what's the term we use for passive movement of a molecule from one place to another? Yeah, diffusion. Right, but if it's a special kind of diffusion that requires a protein in the cell membrane to allow this glucose to go from high concentration to low, right, that requires this carrier protein, what kind of diffusion is that? It's a special kind. It doesn't require energy because it's still diffusion, but this is called, I had it on the tip of my tongue. Facilitated diffusion, right? Facilitated diffusion. Does that ring in a bell? I hope facilitated diffusion. Facilitated diffusion means that a molecule can move from high concentration to low passively, but it needs a carrier in the membrane to allow it to go across. Right? And I think we talked about this protein before. It's called a GLUT4 transporter. So if this cell has GLUT4 transporters in the cell membrane, then glucose can enter the cell. Under normal circumstances, without an insulin signal, these GLUT4 transporters are taken out of the cell membrane and they're put into little vesicles. Here I see a vesicle inside the cell with these GLUT4 transporters. And if the transporters are in a vesicle, they're not in the cell membrane and glucose cannot enter the cell. If it can't enter the cell, then that's going to maintain blood glucose. Right? But when blood glucose concentration increases, it would be good for that glucose to enter the cell. And so when an insulin is a signal from the pancreas to insert these GLUT4 transporters that are in these vesicles, right, it's going to cause translocation of this vesicle to the cell membrane. And look at the membrane of this vesicle, membrane of this of the cell itself. They're almost exactly the same. So as soon as they touch each other, right, they're just going to fuse together. And when the vesicle membrane fuses with the cell membrane, where do you have these GLUT4 transporters now? Instead of trapped inside the cell not doing anything, where are they now? They're found in the plasma membrane. And they're allowing glucose to enter the cell. And so these vesicles have a special name. They're called endosomes. And an endosome is just a way that this cell can store these GLUT4 transporters and use that as a reservoir in case it ever gets an insulin signal to take glucose out of the blood and put it in the cell. Because these are proteins, it would take a long time to build enough of these transporters, because they're proteins, and put in the cell membrane if it had to start with amino acids.
So all of these transports are already built. They're ready to go. They're just held in reserve in an endosome until blood glucose concentration increases to a certain level that insulin is released by the pancreas. And then when that happens, since there are cascade mechanisms, then these vesicles can be put very rapidly into the cell membrane. There are many of these GLUT4 transporters in every vesicle, and all of a sudden the cell can take up a lot of glucose in a hurry. It doesn't have to wait around for protein synthesis. All right, so that's the beauty of this system. The thing that's not so beautiful is that it's kind of complicated, and if any one of these steps breaks down, then somebody has a type 2 diabetes, even when somebody's insulin level is normal as a result, okay? So that's a type 2 diabetes condition, where type 2 diabetes is when there's something wrong with the receptor or something wrong with this cascade mechanism that moves these endosomes over to the cell membrane. That's a type 2 diabetes. Okay, who's got a question? Anybody have a question? I've kind of been rattling on for a long time. In this particular case, I wouldn't call this a first messenger, second messenger. A tyrosine kinase receptor is kind of a receptor all by itself. It's not like a G protein coupled. And I think the only thing you should remember is that when this tyrosine kinase receptor is activated, when it binds a ligand, for instance, like insulin in this case, it's going to phosphorylate something on proteins inside the cell. What is it going to phosphorylate? It's going to phosphorylate a tyrosine amino acid that's making up a protein inside the cell. That's why we call it a tyrosine kinase receptor. Okay? And tyrosine is what? An amino acid. What's a building block of a protein? Amino acid. So in this case, this tyrosine is just one of the building blocks that can make a protein. And these proteins have different functions. When they're phosphorylated, then it can activate a function for that particular protein. Okay, so insulin is a really important hormone. You know it's a hormone because it's secreted by the pancreas directly into the blood, travels in the blood to a distant target tissue, and it's a target tissue if it has what? Okay, it's a target tissue if it has what? And we're talking about insulin specifically. What does a target tissue for insulin have to have? Okay, what does it have to have? Okay, that's the tissue. What do those tissues have to have in order to be a target tissue? Those are target tissues. But what do those things have to have? Okay, previously we said a receptor, right? But now you know a lot more than that. What kind of receptor? It's a tyrosine kinase receptor. If it doesn't have a tyrosine kinase receptor, it will be completely blind to that level of insulin. Right? So a tyrosine kinase receptor is not an adrenergic receptor, but it's one that's used by insulin to have an effect inside the cell. Right? So we looked at two major classes of receptors today, G protein coupled receptors, looked at a couple different second messengers by G protein coupled, and the second kind is this tyrosine kinase receptor. And the reason why insulin, which is trapped outside the cell, can affect things inside the cell is because this tyrosine kinase receptor goes all the way through the membrane. So insulin doesn't have to enter the cell. It just has to bind on the outside of the cell. Okay. All right, pituitary gland. Pituitary gland is an important endocrine gland. So does the pituitary gland have ducts? No, doesn't have ducts because it's an endocrine gland. Some organs have both endocrine and exocrine function like the pancreas, but the pituitary does not. And here I say nice pituitary. Sometimes we call the pituitary the hypophysis, right? Hypophysis because it is below the hypothalamus, right? Hypophysis and pituitary are the same thing. And so here's the hypothalamus, here is the pituitary or hypophysis, and they're connected to each other by some tissue that we call the infundibulum or the stalk of the pituitary. So this is just a review from anatomy. Continuing with the review from anatomy, we know that the pituitary gland is kind of complicated because part of it is nervous tissue. The posterior part is nervous tissue, which still acts like an endocrine gland, And the other part is glandular tissue. So the anterior part really is glandular tissue. The posterior part is nervous tissue. Both of these are going to secrete hormones. But the posterior part, maybe a better way of thinking of that is it's going to secrete what? A neurohormone. All right, so you got to be aware of what hormones are secreted from each of these sections right here. I'm not so interested that you know some of these subdivisions, like the posterior lobe is called the neurohypophysis, but I guess that's really nice and descriptive. You don't have to know the pars, distalis, or tuberalis, or whatever they're doing, but I do want you to know anterior, posterior, infundibulum, and hypothalamus, and what is happening in these different regions. Well, hypothalamus is part of the brain, central nervous system, and that completely controls what the pituitary gland is doing. And it controls the pituitary gland in two different ways, right? And I guess you could kind of guess that because the pituitary gland has, what, two major sections. And each section is controlled in a different fashion. All right, so let's look at some of these. Let's look at the posterior pituitary first. All right, posterior pituitary, we said, was nervous tissue, was not glandular tissue. Here are some nuclei in the walls of the hypothalamus. Remember, the third ventricle is right between the sides of the hypothalamus, right? But this is right in the wall of the hypothalamus. We have the paraventricular nucleus, and here's the supraoptic nucleus. Supraoptic nucleus is just right superior to the optic chiasma. Anybody remember what that optic chiasma is? That's where the optic nerves cross over each other, right? So that's the entrance of the optic nerve into the central nervous system. And what the heck is a nucleus, once again? This is interesting because your physiology book gets this designation correct and the anatomy book gets it wrong. Your anatomy book would call some of these things ganglia. But where do you find ganglia? In the peripheral nervous system. But this is brain, this is central nervous system. So here is a nucleus, which means central nervous system. But what kind of beast is a nucleus in the central nervous system? It's a collection of nerve cell bodies and dendrites. They're not myelinated, so these sections look gray, right? So nuclei appear gray in the central nervous system. So here are two, supraoptic, right above the optic chiasma, paraventricular, which means on either side of the third ventricle, para on either side of the third ventricle. And when they receive information from higher centers of the brain, they send action potentials down these axons, and these are myelinated axons. So what do we call a whole bunch of myelinated axons going someplace in the central nervous system? It even says on the slide. That's a tract, right? White matter in the central nervous system is a tract. White matter is myelinated axons going someplace. So going through the infundibulum are these tracts that go to the posterior pituitary, and when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, they release a compound which you might think of as a neurotransmitter, and it sort of is because it's being released by a neuron, but it doesn't bind to receptor in a neighboring neuron, but that compound is picked up by a capillary, and once that compound is in the capillary, it's in the blood, and where does it go once it's in the blood? Everywhere, because blood goes almost everywhere in your body, right? And that compound then can act as a signal, right? As long as some distant tissue has what for that thing that's being secreted by these neurons? How is it, here are the two hormones, ADH and oxytocin. How is it that ADH and oxytocin can control the physiology of some cell that's really far away from the pituitary gland? Because these are target tissues, target tissue has to have a receptor. So there are oxytocin receptors and antidiuretic hormone receptors in distant tissues that make them a target tissue. All right, so the posterior pituitary is pretty easy because it only secretes two hormones, antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin, and it is done just by electrical impulses moving down the hypothalamo-hypophyseal tract, right? Hypothalamo means from the hypothalamus down to the pituitary. Hypophysis is pituitary. So that's the origin of the tract, that's the destination of the tract, that's how it got its name, releases these two compounds into the blood. And what's the effect in the body if there is an ADH receptor? Right? And your body has ADH receptors, what's the effect in your body? What does a diuretic do? Makes you lose water, makes you pee, right? What does an antidiuretic do?
Yeah, it cuts back, right, the production of urine, which means you retain fluid inside your body. So when you're dehydrated, would it be a good idea to lose the water via urination or to retain water when you're dehydrated? Yeah, retain water. So antidiuretic hormone is released when you are dehydrated. That helps maintain water inside your body, right? So you might guess, well, where is a good place where urine is manipulated or produced? Yeah, kidneys. So ADH has receptors in the kidney. We're going to look at that in the very last lecture in the class. You're going to really like to see that. All right, so I'm just kind of talking about it generally. We'll look at it really specifically in the last week of the class. Okay, oxytocin. Anybody know what oxytocin is? What it does? It's got a trade name. It's manufactured. Some bacteria have been taught how to make it through genetic engineering techniques. So if somebody is low on oxytocin, or a doctor wants to give a big bolus of oxytocin to somebody, we don't have to chop up a bunch of pituitaries from dead people to get it. We actually have taught bacteria how to make it in a test tube with genetic engineering techniques. All right, but what is the effect of oxytocin? The trade name of this exact hormone that's made by bacteria, that's, and it's a lot cheaper, of course, to have bacteria make it than to find cadavers laying around. What is the trade name of that oxytocin? Anybody know? I think I forgot. Pitocin, I think, is the name. It might come to me. All right, but it's just oxytocin. So there are tissues that have oxytocin receptors. They are smooth muscles. And when oxytocin binds to those receptors in smooth muscles, it causes contraction. So it's a smooth muscle exciter. And some of the favorite targets for oxytocin is smooth muscle of the glandular tissue of the breast. And when that smooth muscle contracts, that causes the milk letdown reflex. So milk is ejected from the breast. Of course, that's very helpful when you're nursing an infant. Okay. And there's something else when you're thinking about neonates. Oxytocin also causes contraction of the uterus, right, for parturition. So in those two circumstances, oxytocin is important. It has other kinds of effects, pretty amazing effects in the body. But those are the two I probably would want you to know about. So if somebody is in labor, and it's extended labor, and somebody's in labor for, well, you got a couple options. Let's say somebody's in labor for 12 hours. Well, I didn't hear any groans or screams or anything like that. I'm surprised, right? Because maybe if you've been in labor for 2 or 3 hours, you can't imagine being in labor for any longer than that, right? But so if somebody's in extended labor, and so this is a, oxytocin is a compound that can be injected, supplied to the mother to what? To accelerate the process of delivery, because that will help contraction of the uterus. In the long term, that sounds good. Maybe in the short term, that doesn't sound so good, right? Because the uterus is going to contract. I'm sure that's very painful. But at least you'll deliver a baby. Okay. And if that doesn't work, what's your other recourse? Maybe some other ones. But one thing that pops into mind is what? A cesarean section. So I don't know. What would be your choice? A shot of oxytocin or a cesarean section? Probably I would go the pharmacologic route first, right, rather than surgery. All right, so that's antidiuretic hormone and oxytocin. They are synthesized by the cell bodies of these nuclei, and then they're translocated down these axons, and they're stored in the axon terminus. They're released from these axon termini when there are action potentials that come down through this tract, right? And then they're released. Okay, anterior pituitary. All right, so we said the posterior pituitary is neuronal tissue. What about the anterior pituitary? Was glandular, right? It's not nervous tissue. So there, it's basically and made from an epithelium, not from nervous tissue. It's under the control of the hypothalamus, but there aren't neurons or axons that move from the hypothalamus through the infundibulum down that tract into the anterior pituitary, but there are hormones that are released within the hypothalamus. Those, and where does, how does a hormone get delivered to wherever it's going? What carries a hormone around in your body? How is it delivered? Is it through a duct? No, it's through the blood, right? A hormone is delivered through the blood. So these hormones that are released by the hypothalamus, they're picked up by the blood,
and then blood takes it to the anterior pituitary. There are cells in the anterior pituitary that have receptors for those hormones. It changes the physiology of these cells and causes them to secrete hormones of their own from the anterior pituitary. So the hormones from the hypothalamus that control the anterior pituitary are what we call releasing hormones, but other hormones from the anterior pituitary, we got to know something about. They're not releasing hormones. So here is a slide that shows us some of the hormones from the anterior pituitary. All right, would we want to look for oxytocin and ADH from the anterior pituitary? The answer is no, because they come from the posterior pituitary, right? That's just like a little review. What are the hormones from the anterior pituitary? Well, one is prolactin, right? Prolactin secreted by the anterior pituitary goes to the breast, right? And during gestation and after parturition, prolactin just allows maturation of the glandular tissue of the breast so that it can actually produce milk, right? So without this signal, you will have a breast, but it cannot produce milk. So no matter what kind of stimulus it is, it will never have the milk letdown reflex because there's no milk there, right? So prolactin is necessary. There's another hormone that's necessary, probably you could guess, that has a permissive effect on prolactin, and that is, I could say testosterone, but you all know that would be not true. It is estrogen, right? So estrogen with prolactin will allow the maturation of this glandular tissue so that it's competent, so that it can actually produce milk. All right, that's the job of prolactin. Another hormone called growth hormone, sometimes we call that GH, sometimes we call prolactin PRL. You might see that in the text. GH, released from the anterior pituitary, causes growth of bones and muscles. Okay, and also adipose tissue. Of course, you know this is really important during development. Without proper growth hormone from the anterior pituitary, somebody will be stunted in the growth of their bones and muscles. And if somebody maybe has a pituitary tumor or malformation of the pituitary, they might have substitute growth hormone if they're not growing as prescribed by numerous kinds of tables that tell you if an infant or a person is thriving, right? So growth hormone is important for development of bones and muscle. That's the second one. The third one, thyroid stimulating hormone, right? We looked at the thyroid gland already. Thyroid gland produces thyroxin, right, T3, T4, and the thyroid gland knows when to synthesize T3 and T4 and release it when it gets a signal from the anterior pituitary, and that is thyroid stimulating hormone. Thyroid stimulating hormone is also what we call a trophic hormone. It causes the thyroid gland to grow. So without TSH, and maybe the thyroid gland, what's ever there, can make some thyroid hormone, but without TSH, the thyroid gland will be very, very small and non-functional as a result. Okay? So TSH from the anterior pituitary is necessary for this thyroid function. So you're kind of familiar with the thyroid. Here is the adrenal gland. You see the two components, the cortex and the medulla. What does the medulla do? This is just a review, quick review. What does the adrenal medulla do? It secretes what? A neural hormone, namely norepinephrine and epinephrine, the sympathetic mediators that go through your circulatory system. But here we're talking about the cortex in particular. So there is a hormone from the anterior pituitary called adrenal corticotropic hormone, right? It's not adrenal medullotropic hormone. It doesn't go to the medulla. It's the cortex, which is this outer part right here. And just like the thyroid gland, right, without ACTH, the adrenal cortex is going to atrophy. So it's necessary to maintain the viability of the cortex, and it's also going to cause the cortex to secrete some hormones of its own, like glucocorticoids, mineralocorticoids. We'll look at those a little bit later on. But let's just concentrate on the anterior pituitary first. The last hormone, right here, it's actually two, but we can put both of these together. We call these gonadotropins, right? And again, it's a trophic hormone. Without gonadotropins, then your gonads are going to regress. What is a gonad? You can give me two examples. There are male and female, right? The female is an ovary, and the male is a testes. And gonadotropins work on either an ovary or testes to make sure that these ovaries or testes are doing its job. And what's the job of a, which one you want to talk about first? Ovary. What's the job of an ovary? Maybe two main functions. Okay, it produces gametes, which is an egg cell, right? So it produces a sex cell that we call a gamete, and it does something else too. It produces hormones of its own, just like the thyroid gland, just like the adrenal cortex. Could you give me an example of a hormone that the ovary releases, secretes? You could give me, there's two. Yeah, two common ones, estrogen, progesterone. Okay, so, and the hormones responsible for that are follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone. We're going to have to get into the reproductive system a little bit to really appreciate what these two things are doing. But in generally, an egg comes from a follicle, and follicle-stimulating hormone will work on a follicle to produce a mature egg for fertilization. That's what its job is. Luteinizing hormone is a hormone that will take that egg from a follicle and spit it out of the ovary so that it can be fertilized. We call that ovulation. So luteinizing hormone is important for ovulation. Follicle stimulating hormone is important for the production of an egg cell in a mature follicle. All right, FSH and LH are important in the male, and just like in the female, gonadotropins are responsible for gamete production. What's a male gamete? Female gamete, you said, was an egg. I believed you. What's a male gamete? Yeah. It's a sperm. Yeah, it's a male sex cell. So gonadotropins in the male are responsible for spermatogenesis. And what's the second function of a gonad? Secrete hormones, steroid hormones. And the male, again, we're kind of left out. We only have one. We don't have two hormones like female does, right? We only have testosterone. So I mentioned in class a number of times that you ladies should be a little sensitive to the plight of males in society because we only have one sex hormone. You have two. I'll mention that a couple other circumstances. Okay. So gonadotropins, FSH, LH. In the male, FSH promotes spermatogenesis, LH promotes the secretion of testosterone. So they're kind of similar, right, in the male and female. This is an exam figure, right, and it's a really nice graphical way for you to memorize these six different hormones. And, you know, what are there? There are five classes of hormones and what tissues they go to and what their response is. So here's a slide that tells you what each of these hormones does. But we talked about this already, so I'm not going to read this to you. Okay, so how are all of these hormones controlled? How is LH controlled? How is LH released from the anterior pituitary control? How is thyroid stimulating hormone released, controlled from the anterior pituitary? Well, we said it was the hypothalamus. And what is it from the hypothalamus that controls the release? It is releasing hormones. Releasing hormones from the hypothalamus, right? And since they're hormones, they have to move through a blood vessel. Here is a blood vessel. And here it's a special kind of circulatory system. Here is a capillary in the hypothalamus. And usually after a capillary, blood goes into a vein, then back to the heart. But let's look at the circumstance. Here's a capillary. It goes into a blood vessel, and where does it go to? Does this look like the heart right here? No, it goes to another capillary. That's got a special name when you have two capillaries back to back. It's a special delivery system. It's a portal blood vessel. That's right. So the vessel between two capillary beds is what we call a portal blood vessel, and this is the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel. You learn that in anatomy, right? So make sure you can label this. I'm sure it's in one of the slides in your book. Releasing hormones from the hypothalamus get to the anterior pituitary through this portal blood vessel. Maybe I need to review just a little bit. When a compound wants or can diffuse into the blood, or if there's a compound and it can diffuse out of the blood, what kind of blood vessel allows for that exchange to take place? How about arteries? Can arteries do that? Capillaries. Capillaries can, I agree. What about arteries?
No.
What about veins?
No.
What about venules?
No.
Arterioles?
No.
Only capillaries, because if you look at the anatomy, they're thin enough to allow for exchange, right? So that's why you have a capillary in the hypothalamus and a capillary in the anterior pituitary, so something can enter in the hypothalamus and leave just by a diffusion gradient, right, from the hypothalamus to the anterior pituitary. All right, so these releasing hormones affect the release of or inhibit the release of hormones from the anterior pituitary. Oh, here's something about that hypophyseal portal system. Okay, maybe I should write this down on the board a little bit. So we're thinking about, here is, what does hypothalamus look like? Hypothalamus sort of looks like that. Here's the pituitary, here's posterior pituitary, so we're not so interested in that one right now. We're interested in what, the anterior pituitary. What, give me a name of a hormone that's released by the anterior pituitary. How about thyroid stimulating hormone? Thyroid stimulate, is that released by the anterior pituitary? How am I doing? I think I'm okay so far. Where does thyroid stimulating hormone go? It's a hormone, goes into the blood. What responds to TSH? Thyroid, because it has receptors, right? Causes release of thyroid hormone. It causes a thyroid gland to grow. So how does this anterior pituitary know to release thyroid stimulating hormone, which then is going to stimulate the thyroid gland? Because there are capillaries in the hypothalamus that release something we call a releasing factor, then that gets traveled through the portal system to the anterior pituitary, and that is going to be called TSHRF, because we call it a releasing factor. That's the hormone from the hypothalamus that causes the release of TSH from the anterior pituitary, which then, of course, causes the release of thyroid hormone from the thyroid gland. So you might be wondering, why are all these steps right here? Because we're going to look at the control of how this happens in just a little bit. Different feedback loops are necessary. Okay, so TSHRH. Some other hormones we're going to look at. Oh, I guess I have to write a little bit bigger. How about FSH and LH? These are what we call gonadotropins because they work on the gonads, ovaries, testes, right? They're going to cause, like what we talked about, release of testosterone or estrogen depending on the sex, right? So how does the anterior pituitary know when to release FSH and LH? Because there is a hormone released from the hypothalamus that tells the anterior pituitary to do that. These things are what we call gonadotropins. Gonadotropin. Sometimes we abbreviate gonadotropin as a capital G and a little N, meaning gonadotropin. What does this GN refer to? Both FSH and LH. So what's released by the hypothalamus? GNRF. Or RH if you want to. Gonadotropin releasing factor. Let's pick one more, maybe two more. From the anterior pituitary, what's another hormone? I ignored you guys. I won't ignore you guys this time.
Growth hormone.
GH. From the anterior pituitary, which then goes to what? Bone and muscle causes growth of those tissues. How does the anterior pituitary know to release growth hormone? Because there is a hormone from the hypothalamus that is what? Growth hormone, releasing factor that goes to the anterior pituitary, causes the release of growth hormone, okay? All right, so for all of these, you can pretty much just use this particular scheme, right? Sometimes there are inhibitory releasing factors, but for this class, you could just think of these releasing factors causing the release of these various hormones from the anterior pituitary, okay? Releasing factors. That's all that means. It seems really complicated, but it really shouldn't be too hard. Okay. How about control? All right, so this is kind of complicated. Why do we have all these different steps? Well, it has to do with maintaining homeostasis. And look what we have right here. We have a concept map.
And what are some of the structures in this map? We got hypothalamus, we got anterior pituitary, we have gonads, right? We know the gonads secrete sex hormones like estrogens and androgens, and for females, progesterones as well. And so how does this whole thing get started? Well, let's start with the hypothalamus, right? The hypothalamus is going to send a signal to the anterior pituitary to release FSH and LH. What is that signal? It's what, gonadotropin releasing hormone? Otherwise, you just want to say GnRH. Right? GnRH is the releasing hormone from the hypothalamus going through the portal blood vessel to the anterior pituitary. It's going to cause the anterior pituitary to release FSH and LH directly into the blood. The target tissues for LH and FSH are the gonads, ovaries or testes, and that's going to cause either oogenesis or spermatogenesis, right, or secretion of testosterone or secretion of estrogen, depending on the sex, right? So the gonads then release sex steroid hormones, and these go into the blood. And where do they go once they're in the blood? Everywhere, like hypothalamus, like anterior pituitary. And when there are high levels of estrogens or androgens in the blood, right, and they bump into the anterior pituitary, there are receptors in the anterior pituitary for estrogens and androgens, and there is an integration center. There's a set point for the proper level of estrogens and androgens in the anterior pituitary. So if the concentrations of estrogens and androgens are way above set point, what might be the decision that integration center does? If estrogens and androgens are way high, what is the anterior pituitary going to do? It's going to cut back the secretion of FSH and LH, right? So that is going to decrease estrogens and androgens, right? So in this particular case, right, what would be the stimulus? An increase in estrogens and androgens, but what is going to be the response? A decrease. So the response subtracts from the stimulus, and what kind of feedback mechanism is that? It's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So the proper levels of estrogens and androgens are maintained by this negative feedback loop to the anterior pituitary. So how's that with homeostasis? So you remember some of your homeostasis, all the little steps in that nice flow diagram? Well, we fit in, right, to all those different steps, some really specific examples. Okay, also, estrogens and androgens feed back to the hypothalamus, right? And as estrogens and androgens increase, the hypothalamus is going to decrease GnRH secretion, which is going to decrease FSH and LH, which is going to decrease androgens and estrogens in the blood. Again, that is what? A nice negative feedback mechanism helping maintain homeostasis of proper levels of estrogens and androgens. So under most circumstances, these negative feedback loops maintain homeostasis, right, proper levels of estrogens and androgens in the blood. So if the anterior pituitary participates in this feedback loop, what does the anterior pituitary have to have with respect to estrogen and androgen? Here we see estrogens and androgens have an effect on the anterior pituitary. What does the anterior pituitary have to have? It has to have receptors for estrogens and androgens, right? And same thing for the hypothalamus. If the hypothalamus can detect estrogens and androgens to know if the concentration is high or low, what does the hypothalamus have to have? The hypothalamus has to have receptors for estrogens and androgens as well, right? So a target tissue is going to be completely blind to that substance unless it has a receptor for it. So anterior pituitary, hypothalamus have receptors for androgens and estrogens, and don't forget, FSH and LH are gonadotropins. That means that maintains the structure of the gonads, right? So without FSH and LH, the gonads are going to regress, just like without thyroid stimulating hormone, the thyroid gland is going to regress. It's going to slowly disappear. Well, what do we know about some athletes? What do they like to do to enhance performance? Take steroids.
especially catabolic steroids like androgens. All right, so you're a guy, and you say, hey, I need to build some muscle mass. Maybe I'll take some growth hormone, and I'll take some androgens, maybe a shot someplace. Okay, and so now you have really high levels of androgens in your blood. What's going to happen? Can that person's anterior pituitary recognize all those androgens that somebody just shot up with a needle? Absolutely, because there's receptors there. What about the hypothalamus? Somebody takes all these exogenous androgens with a shot. Okay, their blood androgens increase to build muscle mass. The hypothalamus knows that. So if you have super high levels of androgens, what's the response of the hypothalamus and anterior pituitary if there's negative feedback? They're going to, the hypothalamus and anterior pituitary will try to figure out a way to decrease androgens back to their set point, right? Because it's a nice negative feedback mechanism. So what's going to happen? Hypothalamus will stop secreting GnRH, right? And the anterior pituitary will stop secreting FSH and LH by itself, but it's also going to be missing the signal from the hypothalamus, right? Because GnRH is going to go away. And as FSH and LH decline, what happens to the gonads? Well, they shrivel up. Okay, so that's sort of an interesting trade-off, right? You can have gonads or big, huge, strong muscles. Or you can have big, huge muscles and little raisinettes. It's kind of the choice you have, right? Because it's really hard to mess with Mother Nature that way. So I'm just kind of poking fun at these big, huge, powerful guys with these big, huge muscles, because we know what? They got little gonanitos because of this feedback loop right here. All right, so this is probably an exam figure. I'm not sure. I'm sorry if anybody's taking anabolic steroids in here. It sort of doesn't look like it, which is a good thing, but what really freaks me out is when I see women with these big, huge muscles that are three times the size of mine. Okay, because you know what they're taking. I don't know what's happening to them, but we could probably guess. Okay, so that's feedback control. Higher brain centers, right, can affect the anterior pituitary because the hypothalamus is part of the central nervous system. So emotional states like stress, psychological stress, and can affect circadian rhythms, day-night cycles, can affect menstrual cycle. Oh, because why? Because, well, what we're looking at back over here, androgens, estrogens, FSH, LH affect menstrual cycles and ovarian cycles. We'll have to look at that a little bit later in the class. All right, so these emotional states can affect things like menstrual cycle, ovarian cycle, adrenal hormones, which we haven't talked about yet, but these adrenal hormones affect glucose concentration in the blood. Okay, so that's important. Posterior pituitary, I think we talked about already, two hormones, ADH, right, and oxytocin. Oxytocin, smooth muscle agonist, causes contraction of some smooth muscles like glandular tissue of the breast and uterus. When it's released, okay, causes the milk ejection reflex or milk letdown reflex. Ah, so what would be the stimulus for oxytocin release, which causes the milk letdown reflex? I forgot to mention a couple of things. This is cool. What is the stimulus for the response of milk ejection reflex? Well, it's stimulation of the breast. After it has been prepared by prolactin to produce milk, then if we put an infant on the breast and they start to nurse, that's tactile information on the breast. That sends action potentials to the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus then sends action potentials down the tract into the posterior pituitary. Posterior pituitary releases oxytocin. All right, then milk is ejected from the breast. What happens to an infant when there is milk on the breast? Do they fall asleep? No, they become very interested. All right, so they start nursing more, which is what? More tactile stimulus on the breast, more action potentials to the hypothalamus, more oxytocin is released. Right, more milk on the breast. What does the infant do? Fall asleep? No. More interested. Suckles even harder. So what kind of feedback loop does that seem like? Does that seem like a negative feedback loop? Nursing causes more oxytocin, causes more meltdown, causes more oxytocin release, causes more meltdown, causes more oxytocin, more That's a positive feedback mechanism. So that's really interesting. That's, of course, under everyday normal circumstances, there's an example of a positive feedback mechanism that is absolutely necessary and normal. Okay, but how come the whole world, how come the whole universe isn't filled up with oxytocin or milk if there's that positive feedback mechanism? Because one builds the other, makes it higher. How come the whole universe isn't filled up with milk? Well, because the breast has just a finite limit of how much milk it can produce, right? And after it has secreted all the milk that it has available, there's no more milk on the breast. Now what happens to the infant when it is nursing on the breast and there's no milk there? Falls asleep. What happens to the tactile information? Goes away. No action potentials are sent to the hypothalamus. No more oxytocin is released. Right, so positive feedback mechanisms like that can operate for a short period of time, but something drastic kind of has to happen to stop that positive feedback mechanism. And in this particular case, well, the breast just runs out of milk, right? And then everything is reset until those reserves are built back up again. Okay, the same sort of thing happens with oxytocin in terms of parturition. We said oxytocin causes contraction of the uterus. Right? And there's an interaction between the fetus and the uterus, the maternal tissue there. And it's really the fetus that controls when they're going to be born. Because as the fetus grows, it gets more and more contained within the uterus, and it experiences stress as it gets bigger and it can't move around anymore. So it releases stress hormones. Those stress hormones go to the maternal pituitary to release oxytocin. Right? And then what happens to the uterus when the mother releases oxytocin? The uterus contracts, and what does that do to the stress of the fetus? Increase or decrease? As the uterus contracts, I'm more stressed out because I'm more confined. The fetus releases more stress hormone that causes the release of more oxytocin, which causes more constriction, which causes more stress, which causes more oxytocin, right? More stress. Again, that's a positive feedback mechanism, right? Well, how come we just don't all get crushed to death? Because it's a positive feedback mechanism. What happens? Something drastic happens to stop that positive feedback mechanism, and that is parturition. Yeah, all of a sudden baby's not there anymore, right? So then things can get reset. That is another example of a positive feedback mechanism that is, of course, absolutely normal and natural, and it just happens to be the result of oxytocin again. So milk letdown, parturition due to oxytocin being involved in a positive feedback mechanism for a short period of time. Not, it can't happen for a long period of time. Okay. I think I talked about that already. So I think next time we got to start with adrenal gland. And we got to finish up next time. Okay, no sign-in sheet today, because I couldn't find it on my desk. And so I presume you all were here. If you have questions, I'll be happy to entertain any questions right now. Hi, I'm going to stop my recorder. You could go ahead and put your... Thank you.